Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for tonight. My guest is Scott Detweiler, and you probably saw him in June when I did a show with Guitars in the Classroom with Jessica Barron. And he was on. He's one of their artists that helped them with the program. And we had talked at the show. I met him then, and we decided to have a show because he's a fascinating person, great musician, and also he just does a lot of different things, which you're going to find out in a minute. Real fast, though, I do want to thank Jessica for introducing me to Scott, and thank you for making this show possible. Scott, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you on the show back again.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Jessica, for introducing me to Jeff. Likewise. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, besides, we had talked briefly, very briefly on the other show about some of the stuff that he's done. His education in guitars, he's worked with some amazing people. From film composers like Henry Mancini, various people. The Marcellus's
dad. Ellis.
Yes. So let's start with that real quick. Let's just go to your background a little bit, how you got to where you are now.
As far as Ellis goes, I had been at the university for 4 years. I had been at Loyola in New Orleans studying jazz guitar, and then I was at University of New Orleans studying composition, and I just didn't feel like I was getting everything. I just figured there was something else out there that I wasn't getting. And Ellis at the time was a known educator with the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, which mm-hmm. is a performing arts school for kids in public school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I knew he was an educator, so I just thought, you know what, I'm gonna go talk to him. And I had never met him. I went to a club on Magazine Street called Tyler's Beer Garden. He played every Monday night with a guitar player. On the break, I went and introduced myself, told him that I was interested in maybe going to Berkeley in Boston. But I felt like there was something else out there I wasn't getting. And he gave me his phone number, and I started going to his house every week on the piano bench in his living room studying orchestration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it started.
Well, it's interesting, and I want to pose this question, the music scene in New Orleans, because it's a very vibrant scene. We were talking a little bit before the show. My old guitar teacher, and originally who taught me accordion, was from New Orleans. He was a New Orleans player. But how do you describe the music scene there? Because seems to me like it's pretty diverse. There's a lot of stuff happening.
There is a lot of stuff happening. There, especially now. It's changed a lot, mm-hmm. you know, since Katrina. But back in those days when I was in college, there was still a real strong funk presence, you know, with the influence of the Meters and the Neville Brothers. Dr. John, he was gone by that time, but there was still that flavor throughout the city, and there was a real strong jazz presence too, you know, modern jazz.
Now, what is it now? How would you compare it now?
Now, there's a lot, there's so many people. It's very interesting because when I moved to California, it was kind of a thing for New Orleans musicians, either move to Nashville, New York, or L.A., just to try to get to more of a music business environment, you know, more exposure. I've been playing in New Orleans recently. In fact, I have a show this coming Saturday at the Siberia Lounge, and I meet young musicians who are from Sacramento. You know, they just finished school and they moved to New Orleans, which was something that was never a thing before. So that's a very interesting component. And the owners of the club, I don't know that they're from New Orleans. So before it was everyone was from there. Now there's much more of
So after Katrina, people moved in from other areas.
Correct. Everything changed with Katrina because a lot of the people moved out. And then and it kind of put New Orleans on the map. For me, locally in the L.A. area, it was very difficult for me to get gigs until Katrina. It seemed like once Katrina happened, people couldn't get enough of New Orleans flavor. So it's kind of a bittersweet thing for me, the whole Katrina disaster.
So is it as funky now, or is it more jazz or blues or what?
There's more jazz. There's still some funk, but what I'm seeing is there's a lot more Dixieland. There's a lot more there's a much more of an awareness of the culture, even the food. When I first moved to Los Angeles area, I couldn't get filet, I couldn't get crab boil, I couldn't get a lot of the ingredients that we use in our food, you know. Mm-hmm. But because of Katrina, there's an awareness, I think, worldwide now about the culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
So when you came here, and you studied pretty extensively. You were at the University of New Orleans besides studying with Ellis.
Right.
And so when you came here, what happened? And what did you learn different from over there?
When I came here, it was very difficult to get gigs because it was the middle 80s. And it was the hair bands, a lot of the metal with Guns N' Roses and those types of bands, which I like. But I didn't have that. And so it was very difficult to get gigs. Mm-hmm. Definitely. But what I did get was exposure to a lot of things that I wasn't exposed to in New Orleans when I came here.
Well, you studied with some interesting people. Like, what was it like studying with Henry Mancini?
Henry Mancini was amazing. I studied writing for strings with Henry Mancini, and it was through the LA Valley College. And he was very it's interesting because you and I were talking earlier before the show about some of the blowback that can happen in a university setting, which I experienced as well. Ellis Marsalis and Henry Mancini were the complete opposite of that, whereas anything that I would say, they would consider it like I was their colleague in the educational setting. There wasn't any question that was stupid. There wasn't anything that I was supposed to know. It was just, oh, okay, let's try that. Mm-hmm. You know, especially with orchestration and writing, where you want to have those creative juices flowing. You don't want to have any kinds of, stifling elements on the parameters of the creativity, you know? So it was an amazing experience to work with those gentlemen.
And then you also studied with, I think it's Earl Hagen. I'm looking up my notes.
Yeah, Earl Hagen was film scoring. And, you know, with Earl Hagen, if some of you who don't know, he did the Andy Griffith Show. He did I Spy. He did Gomer Pyle. Mm-hmm. He also wrote some jazz standards. Earl Hagen, he taught the film scoring with a stopwatch. This is going back before, you know, Pro Tools and stuff like that. But the same thing, very, very approachable, very, very nice guy.
To explain to you what he's talking about, when you score the time of a film, what they would do is they had a book of calculations. So you would time out where you wanted. Like if there was something in the picture at a certain point, let's say it's an action film, and somebody punches somebody, and you want to hit that with a musical sting. and it's not on the beat. It's like just like a millisecond or so off the beat. They had these calculations that would tell you from this second what the value of that note was. So you had to time out everything. And usually in major films, you'd have a music editor help you with that. He would help you build the cue sheet. And a lot of the early scores were done like that. And it was not easy to do. Today, most people just watch the thing synced up to Pro Tools, and they just play where they want that boom, and they'll just put that hit in there, and Pro Tools automatically has the time code, and it's all set. But he had to do that, and that's tricky. And I remember I was fortunate to meet the music editor that edited Ben-Hur for Miklas Rosa.
Really?
And he showed me all these timing sheets that he had, and he gave me one of the copies of that book. I have it somewhere. It's about this thick, and it's just all these calculations. It was very complex. You had to do all of this before you could actually write to paper. It was amazing. And a lot of the traditional guys, even, I don't know now if he does it, but I'm pretty sure John Williams was real familiar with that system because he would write in the 60s and the 70s. That's how they did it. There was no computer.
Right.
They made computer programs that would help you set up the cue list where you could actually see beats so that when you're playing to picture, it would change the tempo if you're going to slow down or if there's a meter change. And like Jerry Goldsmith, he would punch the film.
I was going to mention him.
He would punch the film so you would see a flash, and he would actually conduct watching the movie, and he would see the flashes to get him back on tempo if there was a certain part that he had to really lock into. And, some of the pieces that he did, like the Twilight Zone, he did a piece, and that's hard to do that and conduct them and keep it all working when there's all this action and stuff. He did this one cue in the Twilight Zone, and it was like about 9 minutes. That's tough to do. And he liked conducting long pieces to get the music more fluid and it would sound better. But
wow.
But Hagen was one of the, I think he actually wrote a book or had a book of cues. I remember seeing something from him that was published by him.
Maybe. Yeah. I know there were some books by different guys that were out.
That's amazing. And that wealth of information, it's interesting. You don't get to use it a lot now,
No. But
it's a great background. It's
sure.
Awesome.
Yeah, it is a good background. I agree.
So now let me ask you this. Of these different guys that you studied with here, because you did a lot of different things, orchestration, arranging, all that stuff. How did it influence your guitar playing?
Well, one of the big things besides that influenced my guitar playing is I played bass in college for mm-hmm. a year and a half in a cover band. My private guitar teacher when I was a guitar major at Loyola was Bill Huntington. Bill was the bass player for Al Hurt, the trumpet player Al Hurt.
Okay.
He had grown up playing banjo on the streets of the quarter for nickels. That was story. His guitar pick was made out of wood. He was an old school guy. He was probably in his 50s or late 40s at the time I was studying with him. And he was not from academia. He was a working musician.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to my lesson one day and I said, hey, I have an opportunity to play bass in a cover band to play frat parties and stuff like that. And he said, well, do you have a bass? And I said, yeah, a guy owed me money, so I do have a bass. He goes, next week, bring that to your lesson. Don't tell anybody. Just bring it in the case and I'll give you a bass lesson. So I had one bass lesson with Bill Huntington. And basically, he said, stick to the roots, and you'll be fine. And watch the foot of the bass drum of the drummer, mm-hmm. and just make sure that you stick with that. That had a big influence on my timing. The orchestration, when I first started playing guitar, I started with folk guitar, but I could always hear strings and different things in mm-hmm. my head that I couldn't identify the sounds, but I could hear more things happening. And mm-hmm. that's one of the things that I reported to Ellis when I approached him to study with him. I mentioned that I'm hearing things in my head, but I don't know what they are, and I want to be able to pull those out. And he helped me to do that.
Yeah. No, that's like learning engineering. For me, I would get a certain sound on my guitar amp, and I would go in, and the engineer would do stuff. And when I heard the final mix, It's like wasn't even close to what my guitar was. So I learned engineering to be able to tell them, okay, I need EQ here at this point, and mic it this way
to get the sounds that you
wanted. And then it would, then I would get, and it made it easier for them because they didn't know. They're guessing. They're going into the session. There's, you know, back then you'd have a whole section, mm-hmm. so there's five or six players playing the whole rhythm section. So he's got to pull a sound for everybody, and usually they spend the most time getting the drums right, and you know, anything you can do to get him closer to it saved him a lot of time. So if you say, this is the sound I'm going for, try this, blah, 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 blah. And they would just, okay, thanks, man. That's cool. And then you're ready to go. So it's kind of nice that, yeah, it's, that's interesting. And it's interesting too, similar, where you had a performing teacher. Because there's a difference, again, too, performing as opposed to schooled.
There's a huge difference. The big light bulb went off for me that my freshman year when I went to the faculty jazz recital, mm-hmm. And all of the professors were on their instruments and they were going to perform, you know, jazz standards. And it was a thing that, you know, they do that in schools. Mm-hmm. And they were messing with their instruments and they're messing with their chair. And Bill Huntington, my teacher, just walked straight out, got his stool, he had his upright bass, and he looked the most relaxed, the most comfortable, the most relaxed mm-hmm. out of anybody. And that's when I realized, you know what, that's what it is. It's all the performance, and that's how you get seasoned. Mm-hmm. It's by performing. It's, you know, it's good. Classroom instruction is great, but you have to perform. Music is a performing art.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's an obvious thing, but the more you can get in front of people, the better.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No. Duke Miller, who taught me and was that set up, that was a big thing. That the feedback from the performing was an important part of reinforcing what you're doing, what's right. And I have to admit too, when you play live, your approach to certain things, especially with a rhythm section, you take it a little different because you know what works live. If you know what works live, usually that's your safe bet in a section. You know, you can easily overplay, or you can, if especially if you're getting into real counter rhythms and stuff, and you can lose the beat, especially in a pop tune. Now it depends what you're doing. If you're
right.
doing an improv thing, that's a whole other thing. But what I found from playing live, it allowed me to when I would record sessions, you had more drive in the rhythm section, whether you're playing bass or guitar or whatever it was. It made it. You know how to get it punchy because you knew it worked.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. So, what were your other influences in terms of listening?
You know, growing up, I really didn't hear any classical at all. I didn't hear classical until I got to college and took music history, and you know, we went through all that. My parents, they listened to Fats Domino, Ernie Cato, all the old New Orleans classic players, but they also listen to like Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Sly and the Family Stone, all that kind of stuff. My parents were very young. I was the oldest. So they were, I guess they'd be like hipsters now, you know, they were mm-hmm. listening to the hip music. But growing up, I was telling somebody this the other day. I was at the Skirball Center last Thursday. They had a band called Chawa, which is a New Orleans band, and they wear the costumes like the Wild Chapatulas and stuff. And I was recalling things that I remember when I was small. The house I grew up in backs with the Tulane University campus, and so every Friday when we would get home from school, we could hear the bands in the quad playing. They had TGIF parties, they had kegs, and the students would be playing frisbees with their dogs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the you know, the Meters, the Neville Brothers, Irma Thomas, James Rivers, just anybody you can think of, we would see them there, you know, and we could hear it from the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all the Meters records. As soon as the Meters records would come out, I would get them. A lot of my friends didn't listen to that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Those were my earliest influences. The problem that I had was that I played guitar. I didn't play a horn, and I didn't play drums, and I didn't play piano. So the challenge for me was to bring the funk rhythm into the guitar, and to be able to sing.
Really?
Over the syncopation.
But those groups were using guitars, so it seemed to me that guitar would be integral for funk.
Those bands did use guitars, absolutely. But as far as the real funk feel, it's a lot of the horn bands, Rebirth, those kind of bands, where you have that real funk feel. And so that's why when I play, you can see, I'm told this is unusual when I play with a lot of the guys that I work with, that they get around and play a lot of places. But I do a lot of hammering, so it's... So I'm using the hammer to kind of pull that funk feel in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just something that, again, I started on folk guitar, which there's really not a lot of syncopation. James Taylor, Crosby, Stills and Nash, mm-hmm. Cat Stevens, mm-hmm. which is all, I love it. But that was the thing. Where do I fit in? Where do I bring in what I really like to feel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time. It took me a long time to be able to bring that in and to sing over the syncopated rhythms.
Now, speaking of singing and stuff, one of the things I want to ask you is, you know, because you do sing as a cantor now, but did you sing at church as a kid?
I didn't sing at church as
really?
A kid. I didn't get into music until I was 17 years old. I was terrible in school. I had terrible grades, and my parents punished me my entire junior year. I was in my room punished. My mom was taking guitar in the neighborhood, folk guitar. And so I would take her guitar and teach myself. And then after about a year, I said, hey, can I study guitar? And so she said, sure. And I started taking lessons with Ellen Simon, who passed away about 2 weeks ago. Mm. It's very sad. So I didn't sing. At first.
So you weren't exposed to all the Gregorian chant and all that stuff from church?
No, I wasn't. I grew up Catholic, going to Catholic church. And in the 70s, they had the guitar masses that were starting to come in. What happened to me was when I was playing folk guitar, you know, there's a lot of repetition. The chord progressions just, they're very, if you don't sing, it can be kind of boring.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I would, you know, play, I don't know, Fire and Rain or whatever, yeah, I could play it, but I thought, you know what, if I play it four times in a row, it's going to sound boring. So I started to sing on my own a little bit.
Okay. But now in the folk influences, who else had you listened to? Well, Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young Stills did kind of syncopated stuff, but did you listen to like Joan Baez, Arlo Guthrie?
I listened to all those, yeah.
They were doing some interesting things.
Yeah, they did too, but the stuff that I was playing was, I want to say, was not syncopated, you know? Or she'd do arrangements of like Elton John songs, maybe. That were just straight chords, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's play a clip. And this one is finger picking acoustic guitar. It's called Calhoun and Willow.
Calhoun and Willow.
Calhoun.
That's the intersection where the house is that I grew up, Calhoun and Willow.
Okay, so.
I used to sit on the porch and play in the evening.
Okay. All right, so let's take a listen to this, and you'll hear what we're talking about in terms of the folk influence. Gives you that defines that.
Yeah, it does.
Now, was that the AME guitar?
No, that was a Sigma, actually.
A Sigma.
a Sigma, which is these AMIs are the American, there's Sigmas with the AMI label on it for the American market.
So basically. So,
yeah. It's a dreadnought.
Okay. No, that's interesting. Well, since we got to that, let's talk a little bit about this guitar a little bit. You might as well get into the gear.
The AMI brand was launched in the summer of 2018 at the NAMM show in Nashville. And what it is, it's the American Sigmas. If you remember Sigma was a line of guitars made by Martin. My first nice acoustic guitar was when I was a senior in high school for graduation, and it was a Sigma, and they were Japanese Martins, I believe, and they were really high quality. The company that manufactures and distributes those around the world is in Munich, Germany, and they got the license to sell the guitars in the United States, but they couldn't call them Sigmas. I don't know why. So they called them AMI, which is what is on the guitar. And AMI is actually the name of the company in Germany that has and sells Sigmas, and they're very affordable.
So, now, this is solid spruce.
Yeah,
solid spruce. What's the sides? Rosewood?
I think it is rosewood, yeah.
And that's all solid, right?
No, solid. No. Yeah, it's all solid, and then it's got the Fishman, I think it's the Sonatone system, which sounds really good. It's a great guitar. I do solo work and band work, so, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Play a little bit of it so they get an idea of the tone of this guitar.
Okay. Well, what you just heard. So it really cuts through.
No, it's really bright. It's we're miking it, so it's kind of controlled. But
yeah,
hearing the guitar when he was doing the sound check, it's pretty loud. I had to turn the mics down actually. So
yeah, it's a beautiful.
That's a beautiful
guitar. Yeah.
So and you're also the
director of artist relations with for them. AMI. Yep.
So now, before I get into the next clip, which is electric guitar. And into what you use electrically.
Okay.
So you came to LA.
Right.
And so what did you discover here besides all the hair bands in terms of the music scene? What did you have to learn in terms of your playing? You coming in with a funk background and folk background.
Right.
So you get here. So what did you?
One of the big challenges here was to keep a core band together. Because the good players, there's so much work. They're playing with different people. So the challenge for me was to be able to bring musicians together with maybe one rehearsal, if that. I mean, now there's no rehearsals when I do my gigs. You know, it's show and blow. But in those days, it was very new for me because I did have a core band in New Orleans, and the lockouts are very affordable and stuff. You know.
Right. So, but I mean, what did you have to learn guitar wise? What was the biggest thing you had to adapt to style wise?
It was a process of me continuing to try to integrate the funk grooves and things that I had in my head into my playing.
Okay.
Into my playing. It took me probably until the mid eight, probably around 87, 88, 89. That's when I wrote a book of 12 funk tunes.
Mm-hmm.
The New Orleans Water Song Trilogy was in there. And that's I can remember just trying to sing over the syncopation.
Okay.
You know, I mean, now I can do it pretty.
Now, I mean, when you came to the West Coast, there were some bands like Tower of Power.
Yeah.
There was a lot of stuff. And then there's the Latin bands like Malo, La Tierra. Even Los Lobos, even though they're
not as
funky, but they do have a funky feel to them.
Yeah.
So was it similar? Was it different? How did you, because you must have been exposed to all that stuff that was happening that time.
Yeah, I was exposed to it, but again, I don't know. I just had a difficult time trying to bring in what I was hearing into my hands, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay. No, I get it. That's interesting. Well, let's play this next song. It's called Nobody's Fault, and it's kind of a blues thing. This is electric, and then let me play it first so everybody can hear it, and then we'll talk about what you did. So okay. Here's Nobody's Fault. That's a cool feel. There's a lot of the feel on that is really interesting.
Thanks.
And now what were you using there? Let's get to the equipment.
That the amp is a Gomez G Reverb. It's actually a 13 watt tube amp with a 15 inch Jensen speaker. The company is no longer in existence. Dario Gomez was the brains and driving force behind those amps. Amazing amps. I'm lucky that I have it, but they're no longer around.
That's a cool sounding amp. What is that? 6L6 or 6V6?
It's modeled after a really well known Fender amp. I can't remember the name of it, but that 15 inch speaker, there's nothing like it on the market that I can find for it. And it's 13 watts, which means you can really soak the tubes.
Right. But you know? Is it a Jensen or is it a...
The speaker, yeah, it's a Jensen. It's a 15-inch Jensen. I met him at the NAMM show.
Mm-hmm.
I was demonstrating the Peerless guitars, and he walked by. He actually built them for surf music because it has a spring reverb. But when he saw what I was doing, he said, you know, this might work for you, and it did. The guitar I was playing on there is a Peerless... Gigmaster Sharp Cutaway, which is really like a Gibson. Which one is that? But it's got P90s, so you can hear the P90s.
Yeah, they have a nice sound. It's really cut.
Yeah, that's what I was playing on that. And then that was Bill Johnston on saxophone.
And who's playing? What was the rest of the section?
Jim Goodall on drums and Dale Jennings on bass.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
So now these guys, was that just their session guys that you put together for the session, or were they your players?
They're guys that I work with pretty regularly.
Pretty regularly.
Yeah. If they're in town, you know, I have different guys I work with on different instruments, but those guys I work with a lot.
Now, what do you use now to play live electrically? You still use that?
I have that guitar, but my go-to guitar is the Peerless Renaissance, which is... It's really the 335, Gibson 335, but it's completely hollow. So what is that? Is that the Gibson 330 that's completely hollow? Like if you took a 335 with no block.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember which one had the no block, and it was an earlier one.
Yeah, and...
I know the Casino, the Epiphone Casino, is basically a no block.
Right.
335.
But. So, yeah, so it's... But it looks like a 335. It's amazingly light, which is... Good because I'm playing 3 and 4 hour gigs.
Now, is that a fixed bridge or is that a move?
It's a floating bridge. Wait, no, on that one, it's a fixed bridge.
It's That's a fixed, interesting how they did that.
It's a fixed bridge and it's got the humbucker pickups in it. But yeah, and I don't use any pedals.
Okay.
I use some reverb a little bit. But when I play rhythm, I just use the bridge pickup. And when I play lead, I use the neck pickup. Very simple.
Very good.
But because I'm...
It works.
But I'm singing. That's the thing. Because I'm singing. I think that's why I've never been able to really get into, you know, the pedal world. It's just because there's so much going on with performing and singing and playing at the same time. It's just...
Right.
You know.
Well, what about the... now, what amp do you use now? You still use that little guy or you use a bigger one?
You know, actually, I use the Fishman... Loudbox Artist. It's an amazing amp. It's a two-channel amp. If you're not familiar with it, it's an amp that you can sing through because it has an XLR jack. You can play acoustic or you can play electric. And either channel can do it all. And in the back, there's a port for channel one, channel two, and there's also a port for both. So I can go direct. It's an amazing amp, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's 25 pounds. It's 125 watts. And for a solid state amp, it's amazing. It's got some onboard effects. It's got some reverb. It's got some chorus, which is kind of coming back.
Do you use it? You don't use the chorus at
all? Not really, no. Just the reverb.
Just the reverb?
Yeah.
But you basically use a clean sound. You don't dirty it up.
Clean sound. Yeah, I use a clean sound.
Okay.
Yeah.
I get it, what you're doing when you're, because you're singing too, but when you play leads, you don't like to dirty it up? Get more sustain, get that bloom?
I guess I could do that. I don't know. I've never done it really, you know. Some of my recordings, I use more distortion, which you heard. I think you have
I'll play that in a
Shrine.
Minute.
Yeah, Shrine. Yeah, Shrine has some distortion on it.
What's interesting, and what I'm showing of the cuts that I have tonight, they're totally different. I mean, he's pretty eclectic and does a lot of different styles. But but live, you basically keep it really clean.
Yeah, keep it really clean.
Yeah, no, it has a nice sound. I like the sound of those pickups. You know what's on those? Or
they're just stock pickups from the Peerless guitars.
They make their own.
Yeah.
So they make their own. No, they're both. That's good. And those P90s are nice.
Yeah, they have a great sound too.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Now, looking at what you're doing now, where are you going in terms of where do you see yourself going musically? Where are you pushing now in terms of direction?
Right now, I'm trying to push more. I have the Oratorio there that came out last year. I have another Oratorio that I'm working on. I'm still writing, you know, I write for other artists too. But as far as for myself, I'm trying to push more into bigger works, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So you're trying to do more, even though technically it's not a classical thing, you're doing longer form music.
Yeah, I mean, early on, like I have operas, I have chamber music. I mean, it's on my website, but I'm trying to get more back to that, you know.
And you're writing more for guitar, or are you writing for more other instruments like symphonic?
Or... it's for guitar because I'm going to be playing it, you know. Okay. I'll be playing it. It's interesting, you know, early on I wrote my big opera, The Picture of Dorian Gray. It's fully orchestrated. It took me 5 years to write. And it'll probably never see the light of day. And so I realized that I probably should be thinking more economically with players, you know, as far as to get things mounted and get things performed. And like this Oratorio that you have right there, it was in that spirit that I only arranged it for, you know, three instruments.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's, well, what's Dorian Gray range for?
Full orchestra and chorus. I mean, it's about 900 pages, the score. It's
wow.
Yeah, it's big.
No way to do it electronically?
Yeah, we could do it. You know, it would take some time.
Just to get the sound,
put it in
to
there.
Hear it.
Yeah, to put it in there, you know.
I'm a big symphonic guy, so I like
orchestra.
That
too.
The more the merrier. That's how I feel.
I like that too, and it's so tempting to, like I said, when writing this, it's so tempting to sit there and get crazy with the orchestration and stuff like that. But then I have to think, well, you know, if I want to have this performed easily and it's more manageable, then, you know, this particular work, actually I mounted it a year after that one with more instruments.
Right.
You know?
Well, I could see you doing something like this with a little bigger, like a quartet or octet.
Right. Right. Yeah. I brought in,
I don't know if you can do it. If you scored originally for orchestra and choir, I don't know if you could get that down to an octet to make it work, you know what I mean, where we get the feel.
Oh, for Dorian Gray, yeah. I mean, that would be, you'd have to just really scale it down. You know how these guys, they can take you know, the Rite of Spring and arrange it for two pianos. I mean, that's what you'd be doing.
Yeah.
To boil it down like that.
Yeah, but all the color in there, especially in choral.
Oh yeah.
With orchestra, that's a lot of orchestral color.
Definitely.
That, I mean, yes, I've heard like Holtz, The Planets for two pianos, and it's interesting.
But it's not the same.
It's not the same.
No, it's not the same.
Because that's part of it, is that whole thing.
Right.
What they're doing there.
That's right.
I'm sorry, you got to do it up for orchestra. Sorry, nudge, nudge.
All right, I'll have to do that then.
Yeah, that's it. Got to bring it in. We'll play it. We'll play it.
All right, thank you.
But the, so anyway, I want to talk a little bit. There's so much to talk about. You do some interesting stuff, and I want to get to the judging for the classical guitar competition in a minute. But you also, I thought this was kind of interesting that you, and you won an award, I think, for this too, that you play for the prisons.
I just started that.
Okay.
I just started playing for the prisons.
Okay.
Now,
that's got to be an interesting gig.
Well, I got to tell you the story how this happened, okay? There's a guy at our church in Encino, Lady of Grace, and he runs his prison ministry. I've known him for years, and once or twice a year he gets up after Mass and he gives his spiel, you know, donate money, we need Bibles for the prisoners and stuff. And I'm always like, yeah, you know. And then I see him outside, hey man, how you doing? Last December at a gig in Pasadena, Gary Tyler happened to walk in to the gig, and I happened to meet him. For those of you who don't know who Gary Tyler is, Gary Tyler was the youngest person ever to be put on death row in Angola Penitentiary in the state of Louisiana. He was a teenager, and it's a whole thing. You can look up Gary Tyler. When I was growing up, spray painted all over the city was "Free Gary Tyler, Free Gary Tyler." And it was just one of those things where everybody knew he was innocent. He was black. No politician at the time wanted to be the one to pull the trigger to get him out. It's a sad story. But he was in prison for, I think, 46 years.
Whoa.
Right. The life expectancy when you go into Angola, which is one of the roughest prisons probably in the world because it's an agricultural place. It has farms, and they do manual labor. The life expectancy is probably under 10 years because people either die of the stress, they're killed, or they commit suicide. So I got to meet Gary Tyler, of all places, in Pasadena, California, and we talked for like an hour, and he said that people thought he was just going to die, like he would just go away, but he never did. So we got along. We played a lot of the New Orleans music for him because he has relatives in Pasadena. That's how he happened to be in Pasadena. This was a Saturday night. The next day, I go to Mass, and who gets up but my friend who runs the prison ministry. But I have a totally different mindset after spending time with Gary Tyler the night before. So after Mass, I went and I said, hey, Gonzalo, can I talk to you about playing in the prisons? And he's like, oh my God, are you serious? And I said, yeah. I think I was just getting called. You know, it was just the coincidence just too strong. So anyway, one thing led to another. And I have gone and played in the Pitches Detention Center up in Castaic a couple of times.
So how do they respond to that? Do they, to music?
They love it. The prison ministry is through the Office of Restorative Justice through the Los Angeles Archdiocese, right? So it is, you know, it's a religious thing. The guys that go in, these chaplains, but they're not like hitting people over the head with Bibles. You know, they're trying to cultivate an awareness for these guys for when they get out. So they don't just go back, you know, hang out with the same old crowd and get, you know, there's a story of, I guess it happens, guy gets out of jail and he goes to a party with his friends to celebrate that he got out, and then he gets a DUI on the way home, this kind of thing. So they have this program where it's very structured, and they kind of learn a little bit about like thinking outside the box. Thinking differently than they normally think. And then there's like a little kind of graduation ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I go to play for. That's what I've done. And I have played some spiritual stuff, but they like to hear blues and they like to hear, you know, I play some of my stuff and they love it. You know, they don't really get to hear a lot of things there, you know.
Really? They don't get to listen to
radio. They don't get live music. Hmm. They don't get to hear live music, you know. But yeah, it's very very interesting.
Well, it just shows the power. Do any of them express any interest to play?
A couple of them have told me that, and a couple of them have told me really nice things about how they were touched, or, you know, and that's just, you know, you're a musician. It's just amazing when you hear that, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Because I'm thinking, you know, the impact that we've both seen with Jessica's guitars in the classroom with just kids, it's got to be that strong even with them. I think it would be something that would be life-changing.
I'm sure, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in, you know, booking gigs, writing new music, recording, you know, the kind of the hustle bustle of doing music. But then when you have these opportunities where you can play and get this kind of connection, it's really something else. Yeah. With Jessica, I'm actually going to start with the training, next month. I'm new to the guitars in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah,
you're training to teach?
Yeah. I'm going to be training to teach.
Yeah. I'm wondering that. I'm curious if you end up using that over at the jails. I'm curious to see if they respond to it.
You know what? That's what we're going to see. And you know, as you know, guitars in the classroom, it's not like taking regular guitar class. I mean, it's a whole system set up to teach kids very quickly, or instructors very quickly. So but we'll see.
Because I think music is the universal. It trans, you know, and
it is.
If anything can get through to people sometimes that are just in despair, or I mean something like that, to be in jail, that seems to me it would be a powerful thing if it can turn their lives around.
But
it'd be interesting just adapting. Who knew that Jessica stuff could actually apply to more than just, you know, just the kids? And that's strong. I mean,
sure.
The power of what she's doing and how it's affecting the kids in their life. It's not, the music is actually almost insignificant in one way, because it impacts so much more of what they're doing and learning and just feeling, and in general, their whole life experience. It seems, I mean, yes, the music's important, but it covers so much more.
It sure does. Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. That's really good.
Yeah, so I'm slated to play in some other facilities around Southern California too. So,
yeah, we'll have to talk more the next time you come out. I want to see how that works
out. Sure.
Now let's, we're almost out of time, but I want to get through and talk a little bit about this Gohar and Ovanis Andreasian classical guitar and competition and festival.
Right.
So you're going to be one of the judges, right?
Right. I'm one of the judges, and I sit on the board of directors for this competition slash guitar festival. And it is held at Cal State LA every year in November. This year it's going to be November 7th through the 10th. The event features concert. It's a 4-day event. Features concerts. It features solo guitar competition, which is what I'm one of the judges for. They have master classes and workshops. They're actually having a master class with Lito Romero, if you know anything about the Romero family.
He's one of the Romeros.
Yeah, he's one of the Romeros. He's an awesome guy. I met him last year. He's going to be back. There's a guitar ensemble composition competition. So for composers who write pieces for guitar ensemble, there's a competition for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with composition, just getting your piece mounted, I think, is a big thing, whether you win or not. I think that's just a great opportunity. They also have middle and high school guitar ensemble clinic. There's over $5,000 in cash and prizes. The sponsors, you can see there's some
Diadario, Cordoba, LaBella, Yamaha.
And AMI's on board this year.
AMI.
Yeah. The submission deadline for the solo competition is November 1st, 2019. So if you just go to the website, and it only costs, I think, $25 to be in.
Yeah.
Which is great. You go to the Cal State LA website, and you can find all the information there.
Now, how does it work? It's closed to the public?
It is. The performances are not open for spectators. It's closed to the public.
Are they going to video them or something so you can see them?
There isn't a video. There's a promotional video that's on YouTube that has clips from different parts of the competition. But the event that I judge, the solo guitar, the parents can't even come in, or friends or anything. It's just the performer and the judges. It's a jury, just like you're in college, right?
But do the winners like do a concert or something?
The winners, not that they didn't do that last year.
Ovanis is going to be coming.
Satik Andreasian. That's her parents.
Oh, those are her parents.
Yeah, those are her parents.
So Satik, we're going to be doing a show in November, I think right after
the Monday after after
the contest.
Right. And then we'll be bringing on, at least one of the performers.
Yeah, that should be really cool. I have a couple of friends that are competitive. I'm going to tell them about this.
Yeah, there's amazing performers for classical guitar.
Right. No, it's so is it the calstatela.edu/music.classical-guitar-comp?
Yeah.
It's the same address?
Yeah, the same address. You can find it there.
Yeah. So all you guys out there that are classical guys.
And girls. Yeah. The girls,
$25, just do it.
Yeah, the girls made a real strong showing last year, definitely.
Very good. Yeah, well, I think we're seeing that it's now pretty equal. I'm seeing it in terms of players.
It's exciting.
Yeah, and I think it's music is not a gender-based thing. It's especially guitar.
That's right.
I've seen great guitar players, both men and women,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's important.
So. Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, listen, I want to thank you again for coming on. Go ahead and grab your guitar. I'm going to have him play to take us out. The website is www.detweilermusic.com. You can get information on all of his music, whether it's streamed or CDs. And we're just going to have you back. We just scratched the surface.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Okay, tell us real quick what you're going to do, and we'll let you take us out.
This is my latest single. It's digitally released. You can find it on Spotify, iTunes, everything. It's called Traveling Man. If I could be slim enough to reach through the phone, I'd wrap my arms around you and never let go. And I'd wipe your tears with the palm of my hand. Sometimes it's hard to be a traveling man. If I could be flat enough to fit in this cord, I'd mail myself to you and love you so hard. And I'd hear your words, though my hearing is bad. Sometimes it's hard to be a traveling man. Well, God made the world. Whoa, and lately it seems in my weary days, He wants me to see more of the beautiful people and places He made. And it's keeping me far, oh, so far, far away, yeah. Lord, sometimes I'm tired and too weary to pray. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, 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 no. Na, na, na. If I could be there at the table with you, we'd talk about the days till the evening is through, and I'd wipe my tears with the back of my hand. Sometimes it's hard to be. Sometimes it's hard, child, to be. Sometimes it's hard to be a traveling man.